Hi, I'm Stephanie Bollinger, and you're watching A Little Bit of Steph. Today, on episode one, we have All About Me, Miracle Me. I am 33 years old, and I am from the Pensacola, Florida area, and I'm also totally blind. So, there's a lot of strange things about me that I will be sharing with you today to help you get to know me and to share my story with you so that you can learn about what it is I'm doing this podcast for and why I care so much about helping other people by sharing my story. I grew up on and off between Pensacola and a little town called Milton right outside of Pensacola, Florida. When I was a little girl, I lived with my dad. He had full permanent custody of me and my little brother, where we would stay weekends and just random other holidays and stuff with my biological mother. So when I was about 8 years old, my daddy had gone out for the evening, so he left us with one of my aunts and uncles. And the next day, my brother and I, who's 2 years younger than me, we were outside playing in a little like plastic pool, standing there filling up the pool, when my biological mother and her mother, who is my mamaw, arrived there. And at that age, I don't know if it was something that was just automatically built in me or if I just was raised to understand a little better. I'm not really quite sure, but I just knew by the look of them when they showed up and the fact that it was not typical for them to show up there to get me, that something was terribly wrong. So I stepped out of the pool and I walked over to my biological mother and I asked her what was wrong. And my little brother was still standing in the pool with a water hose, smiling and laughing and playing. My biological mother told me that my father died. I just remember hitting her and screaming that I hated her and that I didn't believe her. So then I went to my mamaw, and my mamaw was consoling me and telling me that it was true that my father had died. That was the start of what felt like emptiness for so many years. From that moment, we were then in the care and custody of my biological mother, who struggles with mental illness, as well as, at that time, alcohol and drug addiction, which became worse over time. Basically, growing up with her, I was abused on every level possible. Not necessarily every level by her, but because of the situations that she put us in and allowed us in, I was hurt by other people too. And so there would be days that I would wake up with dry blood all over me and on the floor, because she beat me so bad that I literally physically passed out. There were times for much of my life that I had to go to school smelling like urine,
Because I was so scared to get up in the middle of the night and go to the bathroom because I never knew what state she was in and how abusive she would become. I was not sure what the definition or the meaning, or I don't even know that I ever really even heard the word at this time, suicide. But I can tell you that as an elementary school child, I wanted nothing more than to die. I started cutting myself in places where no one could see it. When I was in elementary school. And it wasn't because, well, I don't really know what it was because, other than the fact that that pain helped me feel a little more numb with the pain that I felt in here, as well as in my mind. So, I wasn't sure what was wrong with me. I wasn't sure why she hated me. I didn't know what to do or how to ask for help because I just really didn't trust anybody. And so, I just continued living my life as it was. We bounced around schools. I would go to anywhere from 6 to 8 schools a year up until about 7th grade. I never felt like I was on track with the other students because I just had to move so much. And by the time I would go to a new school, I would be behind where those students were compared to where I was before, and I just never felt like I got on track ever. My learning curve is so difficult in the first place, and with all the abuse and stuff, I now know that I had brain damage on top of from my head trauma, which I will talk about later. So there was a lot of things that factored into why I wasn't able to learn as quickly as other people. And I'm really smart, but I have to study hard to be smart, and I have to put a lot of extra hours and time into that. I also suffer really bad with anxiety, so that kind of spills out and trickles into all areas of my life, all aspects. So school was a huge problem for me. I just kept transferring around and getting tossed around and not really learning what I should have been learning. So somehow I basically skated through school. I'm not sure why my teachers passed me, or if it was like because they felt sorry for me. I'm not really sure. But somehow I managed to pass school. I tried hard, I really did. I just didn't have the help at home to learn. Because of the drugs and abuse and me being such a loudmouth, the abuse was never necessarily a secret. My suicidal ideations and tendencies were secret from everyone. But the fact that I was abused, I never really kept that a secret. I would tell people, I would go to school and I would tell people, and we were constantly being removed out of the home of our biological mother or wherever it was we were living. And we would be put with different family members, foster care, whatever that may be. And you'll hear a lot of probably of me talking this way in my videos because of how I feel even still to this day within my community, the people that were meant to be there to protect me did not do a good job at that. The court systems, Department of Children and Families would continuously hand us right back to my real mother as soon as she could pass a drug test and do a couple of things in her little plan. I've actually had caseworkers and therapists through the state as a child growing up tell me that I was in the wrong for how I felt about my biological mother, about the pain that I was feeling. And they've told me that I should love my mother and forgive her no matter what she did or said to me, because she was my mother. These are the things that the people that were supposed to be protecting me were telling me. So I trusted no one. So much so that still to this day, I trust very few. My doing what I'm doing in the community and doing this in my podcast is not about trust, because I still trust very few, but it's more about that I have learned to trust me, and I know in my heart that I'm doing the right thing to try to help people. So, being able to trust myself is part of Miracle Me. I just kept scooting through life, barely making it every single day. Eventually, at 15 years old, I was put in front of a particular judge who I swear to this day is one of the things that saved my life, because she angrily saw my caseload and my brother's caseload in front of her, and she stripped my biological mother's rights right then and there, giving me the authority to decide where my brother and I were going to go permanently. I told her that I didn't want to go anywhere unless my brother could go with me. So she explained that my brother would not be staying in that home, that he would be going with me. And when I say home, I do want to go back to that. Home. Home growing up was a lot of times homeless shelters. We've lived in the woods before. Different friends have housed us. Different men that my biological mother would be sleeping with. Different motel rooms, depending on our situation and what she was doing for money. So it was never stable. It was never a home. Our home was the best that I could do as a child for myself and my brother, who's 2 years younger than me. That was our home. So anyways, at that moment, my life changed. But it still didn't really change for a long time, because I got to then choose where we were going to go live. And in doing that, I chose my biological father's sister and her husband, who I now call mom and pops, and their children are my brother and my sister. They took us in, and they had the right to adopt us if they wanted to, which they did and they would have. However, they gave the choice to me and my brother. My brother and I chose against adoption. However, it was not because we didn't want them to adopt us. We chose this at the time because in our minds, first of all, we didn't want to lose who our father was on our birth certificates and in our names, because although my pops is a wonderful, amazing man who I'm tremendously blessed to have in my life, I still love my daddy too. And there's a part of me that needs to keep him with me, because my daddy was a good man. And maybe one day I'll tell you a lot more about him. So they were able to take us in, and the other reason that we chose against adoption was because even though we were told that her rights, our biological mother's rights, were stripped, it was, I guess, because we were so young, it was so confusing to us, and we were afraid that that would somehow give her rights to us. Because we chose against adoption, they had the right to go for child support. However, they chose not to do that unless we wanted it. And I still think to this day that we made the right choice, simply because she never would have gotten a job and paid it. But also because I didn't want her money. I didn't want anything from her. All I wanted was her to love me. And I never got that. So I didn't want anything else. So we chose against the child support, and the people I call my parents, who are my parents, they struggled paycheck to paycheck and took care of us to the best of their ability. They gave us everything that they could, and they did everything they could to help us mentally and emotionally, because we were messed up to the core by the time we came to them. I started high school and was in high school, but got to continue high school in their care. And at this time I had been going to the same school except for part of 1 year, for several years. And so due to different family members being willing to drive us when they had custody of us back and forth to school, so that we wouldn't have to lose that school, considering that we had been to so many different schools and we were, to a degree, blossoming within our school. I was, in particularly, blossoming there. I had been interacting within sports, made a lot of friends. I somehow was, I guess, in what you could call the popular crowd. However, I was friends with all the different groups of people. We had a really small country school, and I just liked people for how they treated me. So I did good there and had a lot of great friends. I think a lot of my friends knew what kind of situation that I kind of lived in, but nobody really knew to what extent, because I really just didn't trust many people to really tell them everything. But they did know to a degree, because some of my friends' parents would help me with school clothes or like my uniforms for sports, tennis shoes for PE classes, things like that. They would let me come stay the night with them all the time. my friends weren't really allowed to stay the night with me because of drugs and stuff before my real mom, before I was taken away from my real mom. Then I got to live with other family members and friends were allowed to stay. But for the most part, my friends' parents still encouraged me to be the one to come stay with them so that they could know for sure that we were cared for properly. Then when the people I call my parents took me in, my friends were allowed to come stay the night with me on the weekends and things like that. And I was obviously allowed to continue going and staying the night with my friends. And I struggled in school, but I did good because I tried hard. And I was kind of bad in the sense of really bad, not kind of bad. I strived for good grades. There were levels of me that I was good at because I tried so hard to not be like my real mom. But there were levels of me that were just so broken. And so lost. I'm sorry. I had a lack of love. I had a lack of love from people that I really needed them to love me. And I had a lack of love for myself because I was basically taught to by all the horrible things that I would hear every day when I was growing up. I know that I'm talked about today for a lot of my decisions when I was younger. I knew that. And it hurts. It hurts because the reason that I was the way I was is so much deeper than just being a party animal or what some people refer to as a hoe. When you're a teenager and you're experimenting and you're learning, mine was deeper than that. I partied a lot. I needed things to numb my pain. So I especially drank a lot. Alcohol was definitely my vice. Alcohol and sex. I knew that the boys didn't love me. I knew they didn't. Disregarded my self-worth, me as a girl, me as a child, because that's all I really was. Me as a person, as a human. I had no regard for myself in that sense, because even though I knew they didn't love me, to feel like somebody did, even for a few minutes, made me feel better. It was obviously temporary. I never felt better for long. And then afterwards, I would sink further into my depression. I would cut deeper, cut more. I would hate myself more. So then I would drink more, and I would party more, and I would have sex more. And it was just like this overwhelming circle that I just couldn't stop, because I didn't know how to ask for help. I had no idea how to ask for help. I had a high school boyfriend who I won't talk about much, but I will say that he was nice to me. And I do think that he cared about me a lot, but I was so messed up and I wasn't a good girlfriend to him. I wasn't a good friend to all my guy friends either, because I don't want anyone to feel guilty for my behavior, considering that nobody knew why I was the way I was. Nobody knew how deeply I was hurting inside, and I was using people to try to numb myself, to numb my pain. And I didn't realize that my pain and trying to fix my pain in these ways could potentially cause harm or embarrassment to anybody else. So I eventually dropped out of my sports in high school because I was too busy partying all the time. I very rarely was in school. Somehow still managed to slide through and graduate a year early. I thought I hated school, but what I really hated was me and how I grew my own reputation. I still had friends and I was still in the same circle of people, but I didn't feel the same about me. And I knew that even though people were my friends, people were still talking, because that's what teenagers do, that's what people do. And I just had gotten to a point where I just felt so miserable. I just wanted to get out of there and start my life and to grow up and be an adult. So I did. I graduated school early. I enrolled in college right away. I also got a job. My parents were really cool about the fact that they wanted me to be able to have fun and be a teenager, because they knew that I never got to really be a kid. And sadly, they didn't know how much of me being a kid was actually trying to be an adult. Some of it they knew, some of it they didn't. They didn't know that I was harming myself. They didn't know how depressed I was. They knew I was to a level, but they tried really hard to get me as much help as they could, what they could afford, what the state would give us. So anyways, I graduated, I started college, I got a job. I had a crush on a boy from another school, on and off all through school, and I found out that he liked me. And I found out that he had always liked me, but thought that I was snobby. And I'm getting uncomfortable. And he finally told me that he liked me one day, and I told him that I had liked him, but he was one of the popular boys at the other school, and that school was so big, and so a popular boy there was like huge to us girls at our little school. And I started dating him, and about a year and a half after we were dating, we got married. I was 20 years old and he was 19. I feel sorry for him, because I was never okay at all. He deserved more than what I could give him, which I'm very happy to say that even though we did not work out, he's been able to find that. So I will say that he was good to me, but I wasn't to him because of my mental illnesses and my severe depression. I had already been in depression and in therapy for a solid, I mean, I had been in therapy on and off my whole life, but at this point in 2011, I got married in 2007, and in April of 2007, and in July of 2011, I had been in therapy for over a year straight, solid, a couple of times a week, from an almost suicide attempt in 2010, that I scared myself with, because I had never gone to that extreme before. So I reached out and got myself in therapy and got some help. Unfortunately, I was not going to a good therapist, and that therapist told me that I was okay. Told me that I was not going to kill myself, that I was perfectly fine. So not long after that, after she released me from her as a patient, as my therapist, not long at all, I was going through a separation of my divorce, of my marriage, and this had nothing to do with my marriage. It was all about the fact that I was severely depressed and in therapy, and I was at a point in life where I just couldn't handle any more heartache. So it was me and what I couldn't handle, what I was going through. My drinking was severe. I was not on medication for my mental illness. I was drinking heavily every day. For 3 days straight, I didn't eat at all, like not even one bite. So most days I barely touched food at all, but I drank constantly all day, every day. I got to a point where it was just so much, and I just couldn't. And at this point, nobody could have helped me. I just felt like I wasn't enough for anyone. Like I wasn't good enough. Like I didn't deserve to be happy in any level of my life, because I had already hurt so many people. I had already been so hurt and trusted no one. So I was just at a point where I thought no one could help me. I thought I deserved to die. I thought if I died, everyone else would be happier, like it would be easier for everybody else, because I was such a horrible person. And I really honestly didn't mean to be. My alcoholism hurts so many people. I physically have harmed people because of my drinking, to the point of putting them in the hospital and getting myself in legal trouble, to the point of causing a friend's life to be ruined. Which caused so many of my friends that I really cared about to hate me. I just couldn't take any more. So I remained solid drunk for 3 solid days. On the 3rd day, I drank 1/2 gallon of vodka, 1/2 gallon of rum, 6-pack of beer. And I sat on my front porch with a loaded gun. I called a family member for help, but unfortunately, because of where I lived in the country and my phone service, we lost connection. She thought I hung up on her, and I thought that she hung up on me. So then my phone rang again, and it was a 911 dispatcher where my family member had called for help for me. The 911 dispatcher asked me if I had a gun and if I planned to kill myself, which I responded yes to both. She asked me to please stay on the line because she had an officer on their way out to me. I don't really remember if I really said anything else. I do remember at that point I hung up the phone, I tossed my phone, I picked up the gun, and the last thing I remember was the act of pulling the trigger. I later found out that when the police arrived, they then had to call for Lifelight. When Lifelight arrived, it was a total of 45 minutes after, I guess I had hung up on the dispatcher. The Lifelight had to park in a cow pasture across the property, across the street from my property, because my property was surrounded by pine trees. I found out that I was awake. I don't remember this, but I was awake, and they said that the entire way that they had to carry me across my property and across the street, over the fence, and onto the plane, the helicopter, I was trying to sit up on the stretcher, and I was yelling at them to just let me die. I have a sheet of paper that has things written on it. from when I was in ICU. I don't remember this either, but they said that I was strapped to the bed and I was trying to talk, but I couldn't because of the tubes and everything. So the nurses brought me pen and paper, and I was writing down things that people would ask me, what my name was, where I went to church, things like that. The next thing I actually remember was waking up in the neuro unit. I couldn't see anything but solid black. I woke up alive and blind. I hated the world. I hated everyone that ever hurt me. I hated myself for doing it wrong. I hated God because he kept me here and he allowed me to be blind on top of having to be here. So I was in the hospital there for 2 weeks. This is a local hospital in Pensacola, and I won't say the name because I do have a high respect for a lot of aspects of that hospital, but a lot I would never ever refer my worst enemy to. I was sent home 2 weeks to the day of my attempt with no surgery or anything. I was kept on a high dosage of morphine the entire time that I was there. The surgeon or eye doctor on staff there was found at my bedside at one point trying to shove my eyeball back into my left eye, into my socket, and sew my eye shut, after my family had stated that they did not want that, because they wanted to try to save my eye as much as possible. At the time, my bosses at a wonderful salon, Hay Penton House Salon and Day Spa, Doug and Alice Campbell, they reached out to their eye doctor, who they trust greatly, and their eye doctor recommended Dr. Donna Corder, who came to the hospital, and she, put in some sort of eye drops, some steroid drops, and was able to save my eye and get my eye to the swelling to go down in my eye so that it would go back into the socket. It's been 8.5 years now, and I still have my eyes. The pressure is so low in them, but I still have them, and it's all thanks to her and to my bosses and to their eye doctor, and just having a good support. I was sent home though, 2 weeks from the day, never had any surgery or anything. I was in severe pain all the time. Although I was already in the process of going through a divorce, my spouse at that time and his family were supportive of me and helped in any way that they could. His sister, being a nurse, helped me to finally get a doctor to listen to me and believe that I had a spinal fluid leak. So I had my attempt in the beginning of July of 2011 and was released two weeks to the day later. And then finally on October 5th, I was at an ENT appointment at a different hospital. And I told my ENT, who I also really, really appreciate because I feel like in another sense, this person helped to save my life. He believed me, and Dr. Botts at Baptist, he helped me because he said, yeah, sure, I'll sample. I believe that, you know, if you have a spinal fluid leak, I'll get a sample. Could you give me a sample? And I said, I can do you one better than that. I'll show you. And I barely tipped my head over probably to this degree. And filled up an entire cup in seconds. Before the sample was even down in the lab, he was on the phone with UAB, where I was then rushed straight from his office. We couldn't even go home and get a toothbrush. I was sent straight there, and so I was with who was at my at that time my sister-in-law. She and I left straight from there and drove to UAB, and I was referred to the ENT there, and then but immediately upon arriving there, the ENT had the brain surgeon, the surgeon, in the neurosurgeon, I'm sorry, in the room with us, and she looked at my scans quietly for a few moments and then turned around and looked at me and stated to me, you should be dead. Just like that. I knew that. I knew that there was something not right about the fact that I hadn't had surgery and why I was already sent home and why I was in so much pain. And because of the drug addiction, mind you, with my real mother, I refused to take the narcotics that were prescribed to me for the pain. So I was surviving all this time from July until October on nothing but extra strength Tylenol. So it was like severe pain every day. Come to find out, the reason that I should have been dead was not only did I have a massive spinal fluid leak this entire time, I had holes the size of quarters throughout my skull the entire time. I mean, just huge holes. And where there weren't holes, there were cracks everywhere on my skull. So I was taken to a room and I was brought into surgery within so many hours after arriving at UAB. And I went into a 16-hour craniotomy with Dr. Riley. It was told to me at the time that I would have to shave over half of my head completely off for the surgery. However, when I woke up, I still had my hair, except for a small, basically the staple size from behind my ear across to the other side behind that ear. And Dr. Riley simply wanted to salvage as much of my hair as possible because she found out that I was going to school to be a cosmetologist and was working as an associate doing hair at the Penton House, and I had perfect pretty hair, so she knew how much I cared about it, and she saved my hair, which I think really was a big boost in my recovery. And I know that sounds so vain, but when you're a hairstylist and you give that to other people, it's not just about just doing hair. Like, you're a therapist too. You're a mentor, you're a therapist, you're a friend. You're someone that helps other people feel beautiful about themselves. And when you can't feel that for yourself, but you can do that for someone else, I wanted to be able to keep my hair. I was proud of that. And
I lost my eyes, which were actually the only thing that I ever thought was beautiful about myself. My eyes don't look the same anymore, and I don't get to see out of them anymore. So something about keeping my hair, it really meant a lot to me. So anyways, I had that surgery and I came back home. I was still in a state of severe depression, but fortunately, I was back at work because, like I said, I had some awesome bosses. Doug and Alice would come out to my home almost every single day and sit on my bedside and spoon feed me. I'm, as you can see, a small person, I'm a petite person, which is kind of why I came out with a little bit of stuff, because I'm a little bit, and it's always gonna be a little bit of me and what I think and what I feel and people that inspire me and change that I hope to see. So that's kind of where it all came from. But so I, you know, got to experience their love and encouragement and support. And finally, it wasn't just that, it was also Jennifer Rothschild. She is a inspirational Christian public speaker, and she had found out about me through one of my aunts. So she sent me all of her CDs and seminars and things like that on DVD. At the time, I was still so angry with God, so I wasn't listening to those. I wasn't listening to the CDs that all of my friends and family had purchased for me while I was in the hospital. They were Christian-based CDs. I wasn't listening to any of that because I was so angry. But there came a point where I started getting bored. So I started listening to her books. And Doug and Alice were out at my house one night, and I was on my last book, actually, as a matter of fact, of Jennifer Rothschild. And at this time, because of her books, I had started listening to K-Love on the radio. Wow 90.9, which is a local radio station that actually one of the girls that I went to cosmetology school with, her parents, her family on that radio station. So I started listening to uplifting and encouraging music. I started listening to the CDs that my friends would purchase for me. So a couple of different things kind of struck me. First, there was a song that I heard every day on K-Love and Wow back then. And it was called Need You Now by Plum. That song resonated with me in such a powerful way, and something about that song to this day, which I can't wait to talk a little bit more about that song later, but something about it today when I'm in a difficult time of struggle, this is hard for me right now, so when I get done with this, I'm gonna listen to that song. It helps me to this day get through. So that song, and then listening to Jennifer Rothschild. So Doug and Alice were out at my house one night feeding me, and I remember this particular night being chicken salad, and it was from the coffee break, and I love the chicken salad from the coffee break to this day. So Alice was sitting on my bedside feeding me, and Doug was standing at the foot of my bed, and they were telling me about how a good friend of mine, who I was very close to then, she got a promotion. She used to do like the front desk clerical stuff at work, and she got a promotion and became the manager. So they told me about that, and I was really excited for her when they told me that. And so we were just talking about work and just everything, and I probably had maybe even, I don't know if I went to back to the, because pretty much for a couple of years, I complained about a lot of things. Talked about people a lot because I guess it made me feel better to talk about other people's drama and issues because I was so messed up and so broken and so lost. So I'm, by the way, sorry about that to anyone that I hurt. And so, Doug, Doug told me it was time to get up and stop sulking in my pity party and come back to work and be around people that care about me. So, Doug promised me that when I came back to work, I like how you threw that win in there, by the way. Kind of like I did you guys when I had my job interview. So when I interviewed with them, I told them they were not going to regret hiring me. And that was the last thing I said to them when I walked away. I started working for them the same day I started cosmetology school. And from what I understand, they had never hired anyone that fresh, that green before. That had just started school. So, and they told me that it was because I told them they were going to hire me. So he told me I was coming back to work, and he told me that if I came back, or when I came back, not if, but when I came back, that he would wear a Florida Gators hat all day long. Doug is an FSU fan and he hates the Florida Gators. So a mixture of a few different things kind of hit me there. And the next day, I believe it was the next day, things are a little foggy still from that time in my of my life. Like I said, I was still very depressed. I was still lost. I was still broken. I was still in a lot of pain. So I was really loopy. Not from the drugs, but just from excruciating pain every day, all day. And so I believe it was the next day. I jumped up out of bed that day, and I don't know, I cannot explain what it is, but I can tell you that something in my heart said that I was here for a reason. And I did not know what that reason was. I really had no idea what that reason was, but I knew without doubt that there was a reason that I was here. And I do think that it was Plum's song. I do think that it was Jennifer Rothschild's words. I do think it was Doug and Alice encouraging me. I do think it was the other people too in my life. Not many people did come to see me, but people from my church, they would come drop off casseroles to me. People from our, I had a cousin, one family member in particular, who was coming out as often as she could between work and school to visit me. My younger cousin, Chelsea, she did this for me while I was in the hospital and at home. She would bring fuzzy socks. My favorite thing in the world is fuzzy socks because my feet are always cold. And she would, at the time, she worked at a restaurant, so she would bring me a tray that had like my favorite side items because I could live off the sides. So she would do those type of things for me. And so even at home, she would come out and try to spend time with me and just lay in my bed with me, bring me new fuzzy socks and just lay there and hang out with me. I was one of the very first people that she told whenever she was pregnant with her first child, and we were actually laying in my bed that day. And so it just, it was just a little bit of everything getting me to get up and get out. And I think that was the start of the real miracle. I think that was the start of me finding me. Long journey still yet to go, but Thank you. Thank you to each of you. Each of you that checked on me. Each of you that stayed by my side after I was brought home from the hospital. Each of you that never let me forget that I wasn't alone. During that time, I developed a relationship too with one of my cousins who I never got along with growing up. It's not that we fought or anything, we just didn't hang out with each other because we didn't understand each other. And it's funny because we were actually quite a bit alike, and she's always been there for me. Something about my attempt opened her heart to me, which I'm so thankful for. And she was also one of my big supporters. When I finally decided to leave the country, moved to an area where it was more convenient for me to get transportation and things like that, her family housed me. There's more to that. I was housed by her a couple times, and you'll hear more about her as time goes on. And you know who you are. And I love you. I love you so much. And I appreciate you. And I will never forget what you've done for me. I'll never forget that. Any of it. So I went back to work. Doug did wear the Florida Gator hat all day, my first day back. Doug made part of the office my nap room. I was getting paid to tear foils, to do laundry. Some people would still even let me do certain things on their hair to them, certain guests at the salon. But mostly I slept a lot in the office because I was still in such pain. That was really cool. He put a cot in there, and I had blankets and pillows in there, and I would just chill out and take naps. And thank you guys for that. You guys really helped me a lot out with that, because of you, I was able to afford groceries and stuff. So thanks. But it was just really cool to have that. A couple of the girls from work would drive all the way before I moved to town and still lived out in the country. A couple of the girls from work would drive all the way out to my house to pick me up and bring me all the way to work, and then take me all the way back home after work every day. Main one was Julie, so thanks, Julie. Heather, some of the other girls did too, so thank you all so much. So basically, they just kind of encouraged me and lifted me up. In that process, I started taking lessons from a local not-for-profit for visually impaired individuals called Independence for the Blind. They taught me how to cook, how to clean, how to literally do everything, how to use my laptop, how to use my phone. Everything, how to live as a visually impaired, as a totally blind individual, how to walk with a cane, how to learn those skills. Being there, one of the ladies that worked there became my mentor. Her name was Sally. She unfortunately passed away last year.
and from a brain tumor, but she was a phenomenal lady. And the reason I'm doing this right now is because of her, technically, because I used to be the kind of girl that was really loud and obnoxious and stubborn and blunt, but it was out of insecurity, and I really didn't like to talk in large groups. But Sally just had this way about herself, kind of to uplift me and encourage me and kind of push me and guide me into becoming a speaker, a public speaker, sharing my story. And not just my testimony that I'm sharing with you today, but small aspects of that, like different groups of people maybe that might be interested in being donors or funders of different organizations that have helped me. Just minor ways. And she would start off like that, and she would say, oh, you know, it's just, you know, you're just speaking to a couple of ladies from Impact 100 today. And then when I would get done, I would hear an entire room full of women clapping, not realizing that I had this whole audience going on here. So she would trick me with little things. And then it got to the point where when I'm at the Pensacola Bay Center speaking on behalf of United Way at their annual engagement event, it's she can only tell me there's only 10 people in the audience so many times before I stopped believing it. And at that point, it was just, she had helped me grow as a person and as a volunteer and as a speaker. And it was just little things like that that really helped me find who I am and learn to love myself. But all the while, I was still surrounded by my church family. And that's kind of where it ties back into, because the miracle of me being alive and the sense of who I am and finding myself, it really all started with God and me reclaiming my faith in not only who I am, but who God intended me to be. So that's kind of where I'm going to leave you today. And I will talk to you a little bit more on episode 2 about reclaiming faith. So stay tuned, and I look forward to you getting to know me a little bit more and getting to know the people that inspire me and the change that inspires me to work towards, you know, to make the world a better place. So thank you for spending time with me tonight. And really excited about this. So we'll see, and we'll see how many times I'm looking in the wrong direction while I'm talking to you. It's happened. Bye, guys.